Hamburger.
Hello and welcome to Uncovering the Seniors, a podcast about the avant-garde scene here in Copenhagen. I'm here with Jonan Rones.
Hello.
And our guest for today is Kristen. Kristen, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you, Jan.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you here, because you're like the centerpiece of avant-garde music right now. At least with your Monday Club.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
And
I'm doing a lot of stuff for the scene, that's true, yeah.
And also you had this festival earlier, this Musketeer
Festival. The Musketeer Festival, yeah. And the Jüderup Accordion Club.
Yeah, so like for the improvised scene, you're like super important. So we
thank you.
Obviously wanted to talk to you because we see you every Monday.
Mm-hmm.
At 5E, performing and hanging out and being a positive contributor to the scene.
Yeah.
So we just wanted to talk to you about, let's start with the Monday Club. How did that come together and how?
The Monday Club is it's really a collaboration between myself and Torben Olander and Klaus Rex. Klaus Rex is the owner of several establishments in the meatpacking district, and Torben is his longtime buddy. They've done a lot of different things together, talks, different things. And I wanted to do somewhere where I could play with the Mikkel Mark trio, which I wanted a regular place, and I tried to talk them into doing like every Monday for a month. And they agreed to do that, and then towards the end of the month, they were like, so, okay, so who's playing next month? Who's doing next month? And I was like, well, next month, let me tell you, you know. And then quickly, someone was playing next month. And then there was two bands, and then there was three. And at one point, we had even a 1 a.m. set. And it just slowly grew from there, like kind of, which I like about very much, very organically. It's not a concept in any way. It's kind of grown from a need that was there. And all we're doing is really facilitating that. As you know, my booking policy is also yes. I say yes to everything and kind of let the programming filter in. I curate it slightly. Like, I try not to have like six bands of people I don't know who are the same night. So in that way, I mess with it a little bit. But otherwise, like, everyone gets to play. And it has really shown me that we really get the benefit of all these different kinds of micro scenes that are only in our own country, but in our neighboring countries as well. And it's pretty incredible to see who passes through and what effect it has on people. And I'm watching that on a weekly basis, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. So also the idea of like having a artist of the month every month, that basically happened by accident because the guys asked you.
Yeah,
who's coming next month in the beginning?
Well, the thing that we were going to just keep it going was what kind of. That's where they took me by surprise. They were just like, "Yeah, this works. Why are we not just just continue?" But I think the form of it is more like my vision of. I like this idea of having actually originally more thinking of it like having a band where the same band plays for a month and develops a material. Now that's more the Monday band's function, and the artist in residence concert are more like people presenting different visions each night, and that's fine. Again, that's just how it's end up happening.
But you have had like bands do every month, horse orchestra.
Horse orchestra.
Also this band with Jonas Ladegaard and Kuba, that was like a short-lived thing, but they played for every month.
Yes.
And developed some music with that.
That's true. We've had several bands, Oya also, I think there's one more, Mongol, Michael Rexens solo.
But yeah, I mean, like, we had Tomo here last week,
right?
And he also spoke about that was really an explosion in the scene here when you started the Monday Club.
He did a great residency. Tomo Jacobsen did a great residency at the Monday Club. I think it's one of the memorable residencies we've had.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the club, like, yeah, it was really made a difference pretty quickly. Within a year and a half. Of course, there were weeks where it was only a few people, but that never happens anymore. Now it's always full of people. And it's only a question of whether it's completely packed or just packed.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic that we have that. My main concern now is to not choke it. By that I mean, like, to not try to steer the energy in any specific direction. And there are many, frestelser. What's that word?
Temptations.
Temptations. There are many temptations to do that when you have something that works. I mean, it's very easy to capitalize on it, and it's very easy to expand it, and to make it about something else than it actually is. And I've been challenged by that in several ways, but I'm really trying to stay
true to the
very true to the original idea, which is what I think worked, you know, the communal idea. The idea that we support each other's music. It's a microeconomy, but if we pay 50 kroner, you know, everyone can survive for a week. I mean, we're down. This is the kind of thing we're talking about. And of and course, now you get Coda money also, so it actually makes a little more sense.
Yeah, and it's not only about economical support. It's also about, like, emotional bonding.
It is, but it's important to point out that that's a part of the original idea, to put some more liquidate, self-liquidation of the scene. And it's important, I mean, of course, we have a lot of rich people. I mean, we are, most of us are fairly rich, even if we're living a poor student life. We're still pretty well off and can do whatever we want. And it's important to connect on the, I think, the grassroots part of it. You know.
Yeah, for me that was
shouldn't
like
be too spoiled.
For me that was super impressive when I came here. It's like the first time I came to Mannheksklum, it was like such a community. You could directly see it and feel it, and then after being there for a few times it was like, wow, this is super welcoming, open arms community. And for me that was really impressive to see, and like really interesting and really happy to come to that, and also different to what I've experienced before in Amsterdam, for example, where I lived before. Although they have like a really, really great free scene also, avant-garde scene, it has a different vibe.
It's interesting because it is certainly competitive, but it's a competitive in a constructive way, the scene here, I think.
You perceive it as competitive?
Oh, it has, there is definitely, it has to be. Otherwise, it's just one big bunch of people going in the sauna together packing their own bags.
That sounds nice.
Of course, there has to be an element of you know, artistic, you know, you hear each other, you get interested in something, you want to reach for something. I mean, this kind of competitive, you don't want to show up and play something that sounds like yesterday's music
in that scene.
And that's actually great that we kind of demand that of each other.
Yeah, although, I mean, that is also so cool with your policy of not saying no to anyone. I mean, that should formulate it positively, of saying yes to everyone. That there are sometimes bands that are maybe not exactly in the frame of what the scene is here about. But I think that's amazing.
Like, we've had the club emptied a few times, definitely, by someone who just played like a shit concert. And people were like, who the hell is that? And I was like, I don't know. They wrote me. They just
I haven't experienced that.
It's happened a few times, it doesn't happen very often.
But I've had like these super schizophrenic nights when like first it was Hesse's More and then Natalia Santov's played noise vocal after.
That
and
was
like,
incredible. I remember that.
That was like, what's happening in my head?
That solo concert she played there was one of the best solo vocals I've seen.
That was crazy.
She's amazing.
But there's been so many highlights, and usually in the same night with six sets, you really get everything from very detailed acoustic improvisation to something that's jazzy to composition to rock to whatever. And that's great. I think it's happening, this thing of you saying it's a communal scene. It's happening on several fronts. Like I think Jyderup Kordentræf has very much to do with this. A lot of the people who are frequent people at the club have somehow connected through that. And and before that, the festival, the Musketeer Festival, which was probably even more inclusive because that kind of captured the whole folk scene, rock and roll scene, hip hop scene, the poets. Also, so
can you speak a bit more about that, because that was before I came here, so I don't know anything about it.
It started in 2005 when I was immigrating to America. Or else I had just come home, I can't remember. I was leaving and I wanted to do a goodbye, a big goodbye. And then I did four concerts, 4 days in a row in this in Huset on the third floor. Really nice
Paradise?
Venue. Not Paradise, the one called Plan B.
The one above?
In the top, the very top. Fantastic black room with really great sound. And we recorded everything, and then I invited everybody I knew. And I was, at that time, affiliated with a lot of the rock stars, and so a lot of people came, different people came. And we recorded everything, and it was just masterpiece after masterpiece, these recordings, and it really was the first time I really realized the potential of this really differentiated scene we had, like how you could connect the dots between very people who didn't know about each other. Suddenly they're on stage together making this incredible shit happen. So we did it the next year again, because I came back from New York. I didn't want to live there anyway. So we came back and we did it the next year, and we invited some other people, did it in another place. And it was a little strange the year, but the year after that was really great. I recorded everything. Then we started putting out records of like the highlights. I think we ended up doing 3 volumes, and then we gave up. But I still have hours and hours of. And it went on up until 2014, almost every year, always 4 days, and always, you know, just really like maybe 10-12 hours of music each day.
That's a lot.
Yeah, because it was in the towards the end there were maybe 200 participants. I mean, and then I started connecting it with Jyderup, so there was 1 year where all the people who were teaching at Jyderup were also playing at the festival, so they were there for the whole. But that ended up becoming too big, you know. That's an example of when you get too clever, you know. It was great, there was a lot of great music, but you know, there was too much.
But that was because you said that helped to connect all the different dots in the scene. How was the scene back then? Because I mean, like for us when we came here, it's like Monday Club,
right? It's
was already
so
established.
Now,
So how was it for you?
I mean, 20 years ago when I moved to Copenhagen, the scene was already then. The groundwork had been laid for a more open way of playing by people like Kasper Tranberg, who was on the scene maybe 5 years before me. So they had kind of broken through this whole. Before that, it was jazz, Nazism. Either like contemporary, modern, post bebop playing, or even traditionalist bebop like post Winston Marsalis.
So that stuff was the two kind of options.
Then there was a few weirdos playing neo music like Lotte Anker, Carl Bergstrøm, Torsten Høeg, but they didn't have. I hope they don't get mad when I say this, but they didn't have much. Like they were kind of isolated.
Yeah.
I'm sure Torsten would say that that was a big scene, and I'm sure there was. But I also heard from some people at the time it was just like, they put up a few concerts, but there was no like real audience, and it was more like.
And it's not a community or something.
Not so much, maybe more like little different cells of people. But this is just within the improvised music scene. But if you look at the whole scene, then I think there was, you know, the whole rock and roll, pop music scene, and you had a lot of guys who were could play jazz, but also played rock music, and so it was like that. And then I think the first people who really like started claiming some of their own territory was the. The early Ilk generation, you know, the Jakob Anderskov, Max Solborg, Henrik Sund, Maria Lorette Friis, Laura Toksvær, those people. And I was a part of that kind of. I wasn't a leading person idea wise at that time. I was more interested in becoming a good musician, a good drummer. I was improvising, but I hadn't really figured out how to completely open up that yet.
Were you still in school at that point?
I was in finishing school.
Okay.
I think this is maybe around 2001.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of where I moved to Copenhagen in, I think, 97.
You studied here at the school, or
I studied here? Yeah, for 5 years.
Okay.
And my last year, I lived in New York City.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I flew to New York on September 11th, 2001.
That was kind of lame.
Yeah. That was a strange experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But after that kind of doomed beginning, when they reopened the airspace and we arrived like a week later, from there I lived there for almost a year.
You had to turn around and shit.
Yeah, the plane turned around because we couldn't.
Yeah.
So we shoot down any plane that entered US airspace.
Yeah. So they flew you back to Denmark, or?
No, there was only two airports open. That was Frankfurt and Halifax.
Okay.
Depending on how far across the Atlantic you had gotten.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Intense.
Yeah,
and
that very
screen,
intense.
The screen was like, you know.
Yeah, but you got. Yeah.
We did not really know anything until we landed in Frankfurt.
No. Oh, they didn't make announcement.
Yeah, they said a few things, but not. Yeah. We didn't understand the scope of it.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but I mean, I think it's almost impossible to back then already understand the scope how it influenced.
Living there right after, when it was still covered by dust, yellow dust, and you know, smoke from the buildings, was really something. And military, like tanks in the streets. Everything below Canal Street was a military zone. You could go down there, but you had to go pass through all kinds of and that was where all the clubs were. They were like,
you went down there a lot.
I went down there to the Knitting Factory to see concerts, and you know, Tony Shear wasn't allowed to bring his double bass past the military. Would play electric bass.
Because they were afraid he smuggled something in?
I don't know. I think it was just, you know, they had so much military. Like, all the military in America went to New York pretty much when after that happened. To clean up and to secure the situation. So there was so much military.
Yeah. Mm.
That must have influenced the scene a lot. Like, I mean,
The scene musically,
that's
hard to tell. It did affect the mood, the mood in the city for a while. People became very friendly and very loving towards each other. And there was some amazing like benefit concerts for the Red Cross and for the firemen and the people who died. And especially one concert I remember was a Milford Graves solo concert, which was one of the best concerts I've seen in my entire life, I think.
Yeah.
Really, it's a life-changing concert.
Yeah. Mm. It must have been super intense the whole time.
Super intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People were still thinking it could become a world war.
Yeah.
And
I mean, even I remember that day or when I got to school and we saw this, but
that was fucked up.
Let's see,
crazy.
Yeah, but that was kind of a. I don't know how we ended up talking about
that.
So anyway, what I wanted to, the main thing is like all these different actions. You know, we have the magazine, the Us magazine, and we have the Jyderup, and we have the Monday Club, and it's inclusive. It's not like anyone is not allowed to be part of it.
No.
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing, and I got that feeling right when I came, and I think that's really wonderful. Yeah, can you tell us a bit about the accordion treff?
Accordion treff.
Yeah.
It's called Jyderup Accordion Treff, and that's because I didn't want it to be called anything like improvisation camp, jazz camp, whatever. So I figured, accordion summit. And it's also because in Jyderup is one of the biggest harmonica summits in Northern Europe. And it's happening a few weeks before the accordion treff. And that's called Jyderup Harmonica Treff. So I did it to really fuck with everybody.
You just wanted some of the.
I wanted a local feud between the harmonica players.
Did anyone ever write you like in a matter of like?
Paul Henrik knows the guy from the harmonica treff, and they're in contact, and they perform at the school, and it's all friendly. I think they still don't really get the joke. They think it's just a little weird, but I'm having a lot of fun with it, and it's fun to explain to the faculty, because it kind of shows immediately that we are thinking in an out way, and it opens actually. It's kind of an icebreaker to
Yeah, I think it's amazing, especially because the term free music is already...
Right.
Has so much connotation to it, right? So if you just...
Yeah, free music is probably one of the words that has the least connotations of other words that could be said, I mean, or improvised music. But yeah, it can quickly become a style or whatever, yeah. So we have a faculty each year of 7 or 8 of the people that I think are the greatest people in the world. Mm. Now we've done it since 2013, so quite a few of the people on the list have already been there.
Mm-hmm.
Many of my main heroes, like Roscoe Mitchell, Wadada Liv Smith, Kit Jordan, Jerome Cooper, have all been there. So, but luckily, I think this year we have a really strong faculty.
Mm.
Mm. So... it's cool, but I'm still always... it's really hard to get people to commit to something like that because it costs money and and they don't realize that we, you know, are spending this money to get the people to come, and then if they don't come, then we're still kind of stuck with the bill. So there's and it's hard to introduce this kind of economic responsibility / reality into people's lives sometimes. And I actually feel uncomfortable with that role.
Mm.
But I don't think
anyone is like thinking you use the money for anything else.
Not like that, but just you ask people to pay when they don't really want to, or they don't have the money, or they cancel.
That's more.
You know, you know, I mean, I found out sometimes if you want to do something, you have to just bend over and take some shit to make it happen.
Yeah,
I've done records where it was very uncomfortable, but I wanted to do it, so I did it, and it became great.
Mm.
And I will say, Jyderup og Kordian Træf, I'm prepared to eat a lot of shit to make that happen.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, so I always end up taking a lot of beatings, different kinds of beatings, economic beatings or emotional or stress or whatever, from making that happen, because it's I feel like I kind of have to enter a contract with each person to commit, you know, and it's in a kind of an annoying role to be in, I think. But like I said, I'll do that to make it happen. And I know I have to, so...
A huge thanks for that.
It's not like that. I don't mean it like that. I'm saying this for myself. You probably know that from your own life, like that there are certain things that you are prepared to take a lot of shit
for. Of course,
maybe you have a relationship that's important to you or whatever.
Yeah. Or,
or music.
Or music. Yeah. I think that's what we're doing, right?
Mm.
We're prepared to do this
kind
of no matter what.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, we're super thankful that you do that for the scene, because it's like it definitely goes much beyond just your own music, right?
And
I'm probably the guy benefiting the most from this still. I mean, I think so, right?
I think I don't know.
You don't think so?
I think everyone is benefiting from it. I think even when you're not a part of Jyderup, it's like a big thing at the end when there's like either 2 days at the Monday Club or something, and all these cool people are doing weird, like, was it last year? Was that Jerome? Cooper Moore was playing. You were playing with Cooper Moore.
Mm-hmm.
That was like
That was an
insane concert. And also when he played with the French trumpet player.
Yeah, Jean-Luc.
Yeah, that was also like the day after was also like insane. Right. So everyone is benefiting. Mm. It's like...
Yeah, we're doing a similar thing again this year.
Yeah.
No, you're right. It's the wrong way to put it, to say like I'm the guy benefiting the most. What I really want to say
is... it's good that you feel
I feel that way. I feel like it's not like, oh, I have to do this. I'm doing it because it's making my life... I'm living in a more hip town, and I'm, you know, I'm also have the possibility to play whenever I want, and my gear is set up, and it takes me 5 minutes to go on my bike over there, and you know, it's a very good way to stay active, without doing anything bad for the environment or whatever, you know. And I have 3 kids, you know, I have a big family. It's a good way to also balance my life, you know, as opposed to touring a lot, stuff like that.
That's true. Yeah, I guess that's a one option, to like go crazy and tour, play all over the world all the time.
That's what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, and that often does affect the family life a lot. Like,
Yeah,
I'm sure you've done that.
What kind of life? But yeah, I've done it. Yeah, but not. I still do it, but I cut it down a lot when I got kids. Of course, yeah. I mean, there's no. That's how it is.
Yeah,
it should be also. But I think it's also a choice whether you want to. In the beginning, I thought it like we have. It's a global scene. We have to spread out.
Mm.
We have to go to China and play in Shanghai, and they have to hear our flavor of the music, and it's going to inspire them and so on. Like, that's how I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going out in the world a lot, and that's also cool, but you can actually do the same thing by staying in one place and then have it either come to you or just deal with it locally. So I believe it really in investing your energy in the people around you.
Yeah.
It does work. Like, I remember being on tour in Korea, and then my friends, I didn't tell them about you at that point, but we were on tour and they put your music on in the radio.
Really?
On the car cool. Speaker cool. system, right?
They in were Korea,
like,
man.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, yeah, man, this is so cool. Listen to this.
Which record was
Christian Osgood.
What record was
it? I don't remember what record it was. No, it was like on the internet, right? So they just like, because
Right, there's a thing called the internet now.
Yeah.
And you're on it.
Your music is online. And then people find it and then show stuff. Yeah.
Cool.
It was a record where you also played some piano.
Mm.
Yeah. I forgot which one was. This is like 3 years ago now.
Nice.
But yeah. So your music is spreading.
Yes.
Shall we speak? Do you want to speak a bit about your music?
My music?
Like, or your philosophy of playing music or something?
Sure. What time is it?
It's 13:36.
13:36.
You have to leave soon, right? Or?
No, I have to. We have like 10 more minutes, but that should be cool.
Yeah.
Maybe 15, depending on how intense we get.
Mm-hmm.
I have several things going on at the same time that I haven't really understood the complete relationship between yet. I have one side which is interested in playing music from purely, I'm just really interested in what I can play, how I can play, which means it doesn't really matter what it is, it's more that I'm doing it. And I'm channeling this a lot into playing the organ and playing bebop, piano, and freestyle rapping and other instruments. But I'm also doing it on the drums, and it's just a kind of being interested in playing something actual instrument related. So that's one side. Then the other side is I've kind of devoted myself to this idea that I don't want to be, what's that called? I don't want to defend any kind of thought, musical thought. I don't want to stand up there on stage and play some bullshit to look good in any way. I would rather drop my pants and move on from there. You know, so I'm devoted to this philosophy of playing. So I'm improvising, like, of the concerts I do, maybe 80% of it is completely free, improvised in different varieties of ensembles, and there I kind of expect myself to come up with something completely new each time, kind of almost forgetting what I have ever played before, which I'm kind of succeeding in doing. I can't really remember what I sound like each time I get up and start playing. I used to have much more an idea about that.
So that's just a total dedication to the moment, and
it's more like a attitude towards what I'm looking for in the music, than it's like a philosophy. And it's felt, and it's reacted to instinctively, and of course that gets me in trouble. But it does. But I'm not the first guy who got in trouble. A lot of people have gotten in trouble, and it's there. It's documented. That people get in trouble,
Do you still get in trouble?
I actually get a lot in trouble recently, also through the Monday Club. I would say I've gotten in trouble a lot, and I also thought about it.
Because like that's like everything you say about the music, right? What you're doing seems like that's how I perceive you. So if I asked you to play in my project. Mm-hmm. That's what I would be looking for, kind of. Right. If you understand
but
what I mean.
Yeah, but yeah.
But you don't know. No one can know what will. Not to say like that I'm some kind of dangerous. No. But no one can know what will what it's going to be. And I think it's happened to me several times that even in freely improvised settings where people think they want to be surprised, but they don't really want to seriously be surprised. Yeah, and it doesn't always work, but it can work really, really well when it happens. But but I think the problem is also that you have to remember that I'm very available right now.
Mm.
I mean, anyone can hear me play
anytime
and talk to me at any time and have a listen or whatever. I'm extremely available. And that also means that if you are trying to maintain a level of surprise in that situation, it's really hard work.
Yeah, that's very true.
And not to say that I'm like, I did this last time, I don't want to do this again, but just like sometimes you end up letting down people's expectations of what you're going to do. I mean, and for instance, Friday night I played a gig where I was playing with my organ trio. Which I love for many reasons, and some of the reasons are don't really make sense aesthetically or musically, or maybe they do, I don't know, but it's very much about me surviving on the organ and playing as well as I think I can play, and they are supporting me kind of thing, and we play three sets in this bar, you know,
Logos.
Yeah. And I felt completely drained after that. The whole day after, I couldn't listen to music. I didn't want to even think about it playing. I don't normally feel that at all when I play.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt like so like, like I really exposed myself completely by doing that, you know, for so long.
You were kind of like naked on stage.
In a different way.
That's interesting. I wouldn't expect.
You're playing some kind of Beatles tune and you space out and play the wrong chord. Like, that's scary shit.
Yeah.
That's really...
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a very different you than when you play drums in 5E.
That's what I mean, where I'm extremely confident and feel confident also.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying I'm so happy that I have this scale of things in my life, you know... Because I also had, for instance, people that I really looked up to as forefathers, you know, like playing with Youssef Lateef or Ed Thigpen, who was my teacher for 8 years, you know.
Mm.
Playing music with them, you have another kind of position in what choices are available to you and another path through what you play. And so I'm just happy that, that it can be all those things, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's like, because when I see you play, I really, what I perceive most, especially in free setting, is that the idea of always playing a transition. That's like...
I'm trying to do that a lot.
It's like, it's nothing should like really stick, but everything should move. And it should, not in this, what's the Australian band that play the same thing, but they play really these super slow transitions.
The next,
where they play kind of this 20-minute transition, but it's so slow that it feels like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like this thing, but it's this fast transition where everything moves like in real time. Mm.
I'm very inspired by the LaDonna Smith and Davy Williams and Birmingham scene. I think they're very transitional. It's in constant transition.
Yeah.
Also,
this guitar player who was here last—is he from that scene?
Right, he was
John. No, John.
No, the recent one, right? The guy who played with Jack Wright, that guy.
No, the one who had you did it last year. The guitar.
Oh, John Russell.
John Russell. Yeah. Is he also from that scene?
No, he's from England.
Okay.
He comes out of. He was Derek Bailey's student and comes out of that scene.
Because I also got the feeling of, when I listened to him, he was like playing transitions.
Mm.
Like, that was his main focus.
Oh, totally. Yeah. He's so incredible. I think one of the greatest. People in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so beautiful what he has going on, and he's really also moved the guitar language way past what Derek Bailey discovered. I think it's a totally different world what he's doing.
Mm.
I have some cassette tapes of him performing in Ghent in Belgium. Holland or Belgium, yeah, at the Logos Stiftung, where he's playing solo piece that lasts like 8 minutes. Where it's some of the most inventive guitar playing I've heard, and that's from like I think 83 maybe.
Okay,
wow. Yeah. 85 maybe. Yeah.
Is that distributed? Like
it's not released. It's no. You had to write them to get it. Carl Bergstrom Nielsen got a copy of it, and I got it from him.
Okay.
You have a lot of unreleased music.
I do.
Right?
I do a lot of research. Yeah. I think actually that's one of the real areas we can explore. Like if we are all trying to listen to music that the others are not listening to, that really gives us a. Kind of puts us ahead in a way, and not meant in a competitive way, but to get other input. So I really try to hear, even if it's well-known artists, I try to listen to recordings of those artists that other people don't listen to or don't know.
Mm-hmm. How do you search for it? Do you go to an obscure record store or do you mail people?
I do that. I email people, contact people out of the blue and try to find out and visit people.
There's a whole exchange thing going on, right? Where you
there
you
is, yeah. I'm not really part of that, but I went to Munich to look at Hartmut Gierken's Sun Ra collections, the biggest Sun Ra collection in the world. I've visited Carl Bergstrom several times and look at his documentations and several examples of that.
Yeah, that's really cool because like the way I search for music is like since I'm totally a part of another generation is totally through like internet, and then you are really if people don't upload then it doesn't exist kind of that's like the mentality or
but you also have to know what you're searching for
and there's so much great shit that you can't find on the internet
exactly.
You can use it to validate things or to continue a search, but I really like this this way of things coming at you where you can't know how it came to you. I just really random searching, you know, buying things from the cover and beginning a journey there from that. And
Or
for me also,
you buy a bad record and then you like the guitar player.
And then
you
try
check
stuff,
out him, and no one has ever heard about that guitar player or something.
The thing about the internet for me at least is like you really have to know what you're searching for. Like it's not that easy to get something you don't know about. Whereas if you like ask people to show you something you don't know or whatever, or you exchange stuff with people. I have the feeling I at least more often get surprised.
And also, but also people are willing to show you something they already checked out, so there's already a filter there that you know is probably
true.
Quality checked. And the internet is just like, it's everything.
That's actually very different from having people sitting in the recordings at concerts and just privately bootlegging stuff, you know, because the artist has no control over where that comes out. But I think... I think that can piss me off is also this when the computer starts to tell you what you might like if you like something or just begins to play stuff, you know. In my case, it's getting really crazy because I've been using YouTube a lot to find out different things. So it keeps telling me these annoying things, you know, that I don't want.
It's also really funny if you're like a bit into classical music and then it suggests you might like also Beethoven's Fifth because he doesn't see the difference in Beethoven's Fifth and Beethoven's Fifth by this other artist, right?
right.
But maybe that's fine also because you want another conductor, but sometimes it's just like, yeah, now you're suggesting the same piece again. I think that's funny, like how the algorithm just like changes everything, and it's not super smart yet, but at some point it will be, and then maybe it's different, I don't know.
I mean the algorithm is made to please as many people as possible, right?
Yeah.
So that's like that's already
that's maybe our problem.
I don't want to have all these things in my life. I'm sorry, I'm very just old school. It's not political or anything, it's mostly just laziness. I don't want to introduce new shit into my way of doing things. And it started when I was very young. I mean, I didn't want to learn how to ride a bike because you know, why do we still have to get into that now? You know, it's working fine with the walking, you know.
Okay.
I like this very fine, nice tempo, you know, you can see everything, you can stop if you like, you know, what's with the bike. It took me many years, I think I was 10 or 12 until, and in Denmark, you know, kids learn to ride a bike when my son learned when he was 3 to ride a bike. I was 10 or 12 and the only one in school didn't ride a bike, and then finally my teacher from my class, she was like, you have to come to my farm. She was living out of the town. Yeah. Come to my farm today. You know, I'm going to have to teach you how to do this. It's getting ridiculous. You know? My family tried.
Your teacher,
my school teacher, taught me like in third grade or whatever.
This is getting out of hand.
Yeah, this is just getting stupid. You know, and so I learned it, and it's this, been like this with many things. You know, okay. Many things. I just
even with drums and music, or was that more natural?
I don't like getting pushed around. That's for sure. Like. Yeah. I kind of missed out on Björk because everyone was so into Björk. But okay. Björk is amazing. I just wanted to discover it for myself, you know. Yeah, and it's been like that with many things.
Yeah, I have that a little bit.
It's not necessarily a strength. And it's not something that I'm like, this is how I am. Like, it's just, but that's how things kind of end up becoming, you know.
I know that feeling as well. As everyone tells me to check out something, I'm probably not going to check it out.
They all tell you to go to Europe, and you're like, fuck that shit.
No, that's different.
Everyone is doing that.
Yeah. Fuck, man.
No, that's different. Yeah. That's different. But if they say, like, you should totally check out this artist, and I'm like, I will probably do it in 3 years.
Right, yeah.
and enjoy it.
Yeah, so I mean, when computers came, I was not interested at all, and I didn't get into that. All my friends became, you know, hackers, and computer live from that today. Many of them do, but I just didn't even have email until, again, someone said, "Listen, this is stupid," and they made a Hotmail account for me, and so and I don't have phone, and
Wow.
No driver's license.
So who forced you into making a web page for yourself? Because that's a really cool web page.
It's
by
not
the
been
way.
Updated since 2012, I think.
But it's
or
still
13.
Really cool. It's the one of the.
It's a great website. Yeah. well, actually, my girlfriend and a friend of hers did that together.
Okay.
And it's really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's like she's really great. She does all the graphics for the magazine as well. And she's done many of my covers, and she's. Underspillet, what's that word? Subtle, but extremely good.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Wonderful. I think it's time, right?
Or yeah, it's time, yeah.
No, I mean, like, I would love to have you for another hour, but...
yeah, no, we can take if you have a final question, we can do that. Otherwise, it's been nice, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things I can't... Something final and short. Not
did you ever hear the joke about the guy who had an orange forehand?
No.
You never heard this joke?
No.
Seriously?
No. Yeah, I mean,
this was
seriously.
This was told to me by Will Jones, who is was a baritone player. He's one of Ryan Blutnick's friends, and then he moved to New York and was in an Afro band, and then he got a bar and owned a bar for a while. I'm not sure what he's doing now. It's one of the greatest jokes I ever heard.
Okay.
This guy, he's like a mathematical mastermind. And he has just got this thing with numbers, and he quickly, you know, gets on the stock market. By the time he's 21 years old, he's a millionaire. You know, he just can do no wrong. He can just see what to do all the time. He's making so much money and still going so great. And then one day he makes a mistake, and he's always betting everything to get more money. So one day he makes a mistake and he loses everything, becomes homeless, and he's sitting on the street and he has nothing. His wife left him, of course, everyone left him. He's like, fuck this, man, I can use my talents for something. I mean, I've become a criminal. I just use my mind to think out the greatest heist in the world and steal a lot of millions. So he does this, and he spends a year planning the perfect robbery. And he makes the robbery. He's out of the bank, and he has two bags full of $1,000 bills. It's just... Is there such a thing as $1,000 bills?
So,
maybe $500 bills, a lot of dollars, many millions. And just as he's about, he has also a plane ticket to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And he's going to just immigrate to Puerto Rico and just have a time of his life. And then suddenly the cops are like everywhere. Something went wrong. He jumps into the car and he just drives to the airport. The cops are following him and he makes it to the airport. He runs in, he checks in. Gets to the plane and plane takes off and the cops are on the runway shooting after the plane and he gets off in the air and it's like I made it. I can't believe I made it. You know, I have all this millions of dollars here in my two suitcases. I made it.
Yeah.
He puts it up in the baggage, you know, he sits down, he starts reading the in-flight magazine. He's like, fuck, I made it. I can't believe it. Then he looks over at the guy sitting next to him. And he's a perfectly normal guy looking, sitting also reading the InFlat magazine. Everything normal, until we get to around here. Then his hand starts to turn orange. And in the end, it just becomes a big orange instead of a hand.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he can't, you know, he can't believe it. I mean, it's just so weird. It looks so weird. And it's so surreal. Also from all the drama he just came from, the chase. And so after a while, he goes like, I'm sorry to disturb you, sir, but it's just, you know, this hand you have, you've got an orange instead of a hand. It's just, I have to ask, like, what's the story behind that? Like, how did you get this? And the guy says, well, it's a long flight, you know. I'll tell you, it was many years ago. I was in the Sahara Desert in a kind of a safari trip with some other tourists, and there was a terrible sandstorm, and I got away from the group, and I thought I was going to die, but then I saw this cave, and I went into the cave, and there was I stumbled upon this lamp, and I rubbed the lamp, and out came a genie.
Uh-oh.
And the genie said, you know, you freed me after 300 years of captivity. You know, I want to grant you 3 wishes. And you can ask for anything. And the guy says, okay, well, first of all, I would like to have someone in my life who just really loves me for who I am, and who, you know, will always find me attractive and interesting for the rest of my life. And the genie says, it's done. And then this woman walks in to the cave, and she's like, I love you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. And she's like, so what's the other wish? I want to have as much money as... I don't ever want to have to think about money again. The genie says, it's done. I mean, if you had... You could call your bank, and you would see you have a ridiculous amount of money, you know, whatever, always. So they traveled the world, or we traveled the world. You know, we went to Asia, we went to Australia. 7 years, traveled all around the world, had so much fun. The genie kept saying, you know, what's the third wish? But we had so much fun, we forgot, you know. So finally, the genie in Miami, the genie comes up. He's like, listen, you got to, you know, cash in the third wish. I can't be traveling around with you guys anymore. I'm watching you guys, you know, fuck all the time. I'm sick tired of this. So the guy goes, well, I mean, I have everything. I mean, I don't want anything. And Genie says, well, I mean, you got to say something now. And then he says, well, okay, then I would like an orange for a hand.
Thank you very much. I was uncovering the scene with Kristen. Yeah. And hope to see you again. Yeah. See you again. Yeah, bye-bye.
Yeah.